Greetings and welcome to Edgy Ideas, the podcast that explores what it means to live the good life and create the good society in our disruptive age. My name is Simon Western, and I will be talking to invited guests about diverse topics, exploring social conscious and unconscious dynamics and desires. Welcome to this edition of Edgy Ideas Podcast. I'm delighted to welcome Michelle McMahon. Michelle is a senior research fellow at Violet Vines Marshman Research Centre, and she's a proud Yorta Yorta woman living on Djara country in northern Victoria, Australia. Michelle positions First Nations worldviews, concepts and processes for application within the health and healing sector. She led On Country, an Aboriginal youth leadership mentoring program, and many other programs. And I know that Michelle was recently working in the health sector in Zimbabwe. Michelle, you're very welcome to Edgy Ideas. We're delighted to have you here. And I know you want to acknowledge the land and your ancestors before we start. So over to you.
Thank you so much, Simon. And thank you for the invitation to chat. I would like to acknowledge I am currently here on Djara country in Victoria, Australia, and my own community, my own ancestors are actually just 10 minutes down the behind me down the road. So I'd also like to acknowledge the Yorta Yorta community. But also just as much acknowledge the country that everyone else is on and the country that you're on, Simon. Nature, country, land, the soil that holds us. And the ancestors connected to those particular tracts of landscape that hold us and they keep us strong every day. So thank you for the opportunity to acknowledgement.
Thank you, Michelle. And I've just been on the beach acknowledging the land myself and the sun rising. It's been absolutely beautiful here. And I know that you have a connection to where I am. So you have family ancestors going back to County Clare, don't you?
I do. And I have I think there's 6 girls in my family, and I'm probably, there's only myself and one other girl who hasn't made it back to County Clare. So definitely on the list, hopefully shortly.
We got to invite you for a workshop. It's going to be good. We'll try and get that organised next year.
Thank you, Simon.
We'll try to do that.
You'll see a crazy Aboriginal woman running madly for the airport.
Yeah. I think you'll absolutely love it here. And I think people are very open to your worldview. So let's talk about First Nations worldviews, because a lot of the work I'm doing at the moment is I'm questioning modernity. I mean, the modern mindset and modernity mindset seems to be like at the heart of so many of our problems. People are still trying to solve problems using the same mindset. And I think we really need to question that. And I've worked with you before, and I know that you're a very rich source of thinking on this. So can we start to talk about First Nations worldviews and what that starts to mean for us?
For sure. And it was lovely that you did acknowledge my Irish ancestry as well, because it kind of started my mum is Yorta Yorta, she's Aboriginal, and my dad's family was from County Clare. And I didn't realise that combination meant that I was actually, not growing up with a particular understanding of reality that was similar to lots of other Australian kids. And so I think that's kind of where it started. I would hit school, I would hit education, I'd hit jobs, and I'd be like, what are these people talking about? I have no idea. You know, I think worldviews inform our processes and they inform our humour. So many things, what we prioritize. And so, it can become a stumbling block. It can empower you to feel a sense of belonging with your views of reality, but can also become, a stumbling block when you feel like you don't belong. So I started to question that, and that led me into, okay, so what are, in Australia, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander or First Nations worldviews? And that was a wonderful, pathway of discovery and learning, and I was honoured to hear perspectives of Aboriginal academic leaders and elders, And it was academic. It was academic work, but it was also healing for me, you know, what I talked about. But I very quickly realized that from a First Nations perspective, that it's more than human.
Yeah.
Much, much more than human. And that seemed to be one of the biggest differences between what you'd call the contemporary world, or, you know, the Western society, which has, over a period of history, kind of brought it back down, back down, back down to only the human mind being, you know, part of an understanding of, you know, how do we know ourselves as in this universe. So that's probably the biggest difference. But then it didn't take long for me to, I don't know, read more, meet people, have great conversations, to realize there are so many people groups around the world. You know, Maori people in New Zealand, Hawaiians, Islanders, Native Americans, Asian, African, that, of course, cultures, languages are incredibly different, unique, sovereign. But the philosophy that it's more than human, there was a similar philosophy underpinning, you know, a lot of the academic and conversations that I was hearing.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's the modern mindset, from what I can see, is, you know, it's done some brilliant science. We can't argue with some of the brilliant science it's done, and it's made some huge gains. But it's a very reductionist way of thinking, and it reduces kind of the worldview firstly to humans, and then to humans controlling the world around them. It seems to me that it was all about kind of control, really. How can we control nature so that we can use nature as a resource for our own good? How can we control each other, actually, which led to slavery and led to, you know, some of the terrible things which happened. So this idea of controlling things around us as if that would make us safe has been just so damaging, and is so embedded in us, and we still want to control our own lives and control our destinies and control nature. And it's just, it's completely limited us and created so many, many problems, I think.
For sure. And what you said just then, embedded in us, that's the bit that, as an Aboriginal woman, I want to get a digging stick and, like, okay, let's dig away at that one.
Yeah.
How did this process of embedding occur to human beings? And so from my understanding, and I would love to hear what other people have got to say, I took it back to the Great Chain of Being with Aristotle, and there's been so many iterations of that, you know, since then.
Yeah.
But the idea that entities in this world are in a hierarchy.
Yeah.
I think that mindset that there is a hierarchy, and not only is there a hierarchy between animals, plants, land, and humans, and even between humans, but it's ordained.
Yeah.
that's like, you know, putting some super petrol in a car when that wouldn't come on. And so I think, like, as human beings, we've tossed out some ways of thinking, or we're in the processes, like, you know, there's some strong conversations occurring now around race and racism. So I hope that this idea that humans are the apex entity, I hope that concept, the whole concept of hierarchy, if there is a day when it is also obsolete and gone.
I hope so too. I mean, but this idea of it being embedded in us is really problematic. I mean, I've been working with this for a decade or so, and it's still embedded in me. You know, it's like you're so conditioned to a way of being that it's actually very, very difficult. But it's not so long ago, I would say two generations ago, in the west coast of Ireland, that people were still alive, so the world was animated around them, that the spirit world was around them, that the rocks and the trees and the plants and the animals were animated spirit filled beings. You know, that wasn't so far away, even in the west coast of Ireland. You know, it was, and certainly that First Nations view. I mean, we think of the world as humans being alive, animals being kind of secondary, and then sort of plants and rocks that have no animation, no spirit world. But that's very different from your worldview, isn't it?
Yeah. So there is the 100% belief that every single every single entity. And when I use the word entity, I know it's kind of like a weird word, but like where entities, rocks are entities, plants are, the land is, the souls, you know, every entity is actually infused in spirit. And so when everything, when you think of everything being infused in spirit, it changes everything, because therefore everything then becomes family. And then if everything is family, you suddenly have responsibilities. So it really changes everything.
And it's kind of interesting.
Can I say on that point about changing everything? There's a beautiful side to it, and that's support. So like for a human being that believes that everything is infused with spirit, and they hold relationality to all entities, then that's another whole support system they've got. The sense of belonging is more than human.
I mean, that's for me, that's really, really important. I mean, I'm trying to think about what the Eco Leadership Institute can be doing, and we've embarked on this project called Reenchanting Our Worlds. And it's this re-enchantment, it's like modernity has disenchanted us. It's like we've become separate, we've become cut off, we've become alienated, and we've become disenchanted. And for me, it's fundamental that we have to re-enchant ourselves. And that, like you say, it does mean reconnecting. It's like it's more than support. It's like you actually become whole again, because you're reconnected to that's what's around you. And people know this, that when they do walk the beach or walk in the forest, they know that they feel differently. You know, it kind of makes sense to your body, even if your cognitive mind might have a different view. But your body knows, you know, that we're embedded in this kind of natural world around us.
And whether you come at this like in a metaphysical or spiritual way, or if you come at it from a scientific way, I just recently had a great conversation with my son about epigenetic science and how we carry the ancestral memory in our DNA. Or we might have, myself and my son, we might have a great chat about, you know, quantum mechanics and the invisible part, the particles. I think that's one of the things as humans we can hold, that there are many, many different ways of discussing relationality. And people will use different words.
And relationality is a good way of couching this, because it is very much about having relationships, isn't it? It's very much about, and we think I study as a therapist, we think about relationships, you know, we immediately go human to human, you know, that's the immediate thing. And yet you go somewhere completely different with that.
For sure. So in intake, you know, back in when I was working in more case management role, you know, who is your family? Who is your doctor? Who is your GP? You know, what plants make you feel strong? What animals are part of your family? Is there a particular type of weather or season that, you know, if you're having a hard day, it makes you feel? So it is very much, and then also what ancestors are part of your story of yourself, that give you strength, or give you identity. That's probably the big one. So it's knowing someone, you know, there's a word, you know, holistic, but it's kind of, it just sort of blows the, you know, being holistic out so much broader. And when we work with families, Aboriginal families, and people might say, look, I'm an ocean woman. Ocean is important to me. It's been important to my grandparents, my great-grandparents. Then that becomes part of, in a way, the intervention. Okay, so how can we bring the ocean back into your daily life? You know, this entity that makes you feel so, so strong, that you feel such rapport with. So it becomes part of like the intervention plan. It's a different way of being.
Yeah, can you say more about ancestors? Because I think it's very interesting, because, you know, the Western modern mindset has, you know, we pray for the dead, and, you know, you might have a religious belief, but it's actually a weak connection to our ancestors. But for you, it's fundamental, isn't it? It's part of this ecosystem you kind of live with and relate to. Can you say a bit more about that?
For sure. So from from my own, because you can't speak for all Aboriginal people, but from my own understanding of relationality, there are core concepts, and we've, you know, everything's infused in spirit is one of them, but cyclical time is the other one. And that's my, you know, wording for it. Other people might have different words, but the whole concept of cyclical time is that in any moment, time is overlapping. So I'm sitting here with yourself, Simon. I'm a flesh and person, but equally my ancestors are with me just as much as you're with me. Keep me strong. I shall talk about this, shall talk about that. Be calm, you'll be fine, shall. I'm not alone. But also equally, Simon, is my unborn great-great-grandchildren. Mm-hmm. So that keeps me accountable. What do I say? What do I don't say? You know, am I ethical? Am I thinking about, you know, what the planet will look like or what the land looks like for them in the future? You know, it's very much long-term decision-making and being accountable. So that cyclical time is that whole belief that the unseen world is which includes the spirit world, maybe water spirits from different rivers or other entities. Like my dad used to say, put something out for the little people.
Yeah.
And but you know, or you know, knowing that your ancestors are with you. So like for when children are being born, we'll watch the mum, the pregnant mum. Is she sleeping or not sleeping? Is she wanting spicy food? She usually listens to the classical music, but now she's got rock and roll on. Like, we'll look for any clues to understand the spirit of the child that's coming. And then we'll associate. Ah, you know, it's the this particular child coming has a strong connection to this ancestor or that ancestor. And then our decision making, like in my own language, Garaba, which means wait a little bit. So I might need wait a little bit to decide a particular direction in my life. And that might mean going for a walk. It might mean spending time in nature. It might be thinking about my dreams. But that is also to enable my ancestors to be part of my everyday life and my decision making. So it's giving a little bit more time. So, yeah, that's just a few, but definitely a part of my everyday life.
I remember talking to you in the past about time and time in the West. I think it was the railways, was the first kind of problem in the sense that when they invented the railways, they had to kind of bring time to everyone's lives because you had to kind of know when a train was going to arrive, when it's going to leave, and then the kind of clock became endemic everywhere, and the factory kind of came that you started work at 9 o'clock and you finished at 5 o'clock or 7 o'clock. And like my first job in a factory, I had to clock in and clock out, you know, with a card. And that sort of the way time gets inside of us is very different from a pre-modern world, a First Nations world, where you were in cyclical time, you were in tune with the seasons, you were in tune with your body, you were in tune with nature's bounty, you know, when things came in season, out of season. And that's really changed our relationship to time. And I think that's been very damaging. And I know that you say that, you know, you still have a kind of a different relationship to time.
For sure. And I think that time is a great example, the concepts, because like, as you said, it's so linear now, where time used to be a concept that enabled us to have a stronger relationship with the land that we're walking on, with the environment that we're in, with people. So time marked particular celebrations, particular ceremonies. And so by adhering to those ceremonies, you know, whether it's spring or whether it's time to harvest or whether it's time to celebrate something, we're keeping relationship with that particular entity, whether it's a crop or whether it's, you know, someone's birthday. Time was used to mark relationship and to hold relationship. So and which in by participating in time that way, you know, the different times of harvest and the different seasons, you're maintaining balance. So the other really important, because you know how like relationships are always changing. So like when I first met you, Simon, you know, I was like, Simon, that's his name, but shy. And now, like, this is the, whatever it is, the fourth or fifth time we've chatted, like, haven't heard from Simon, but we'll be on. Like you develop little nuanced. So it's the same in that understanding of time. When we use it as a form of connection and celebration, we're changing our relationship with whether it's a particular area of land or a river, because we're holding that relationship. and which is so important for the big concept of renewal, which is maintaining that ideal set of conditions for human beings to exist.
Yeah.
Which is a big one, that one.
It's massive, and because we've been so blind, kind of cyclical time, we've been so blind to the future, we have just kind of just, you know, we created these huge kind of urban centers, and we've created such a lot of damage to the climate and things, and we are out of tune with time. We're really out of step, and we're still, we're in flight, really. We run away from our connection to others and to time. It's not surprising that people are fearful, anxious, you know. It's because they're mentally and physically cut off from what's around them. It's really fundamental to existential kind of a challenge, isn't it?
Yeah, for sure. And like you said, Simon, I've been fortunate to spend a bit of time in Zimbabwe in the last few years. And so the other component to relationality is collective identity. So I've been able to see I have it in my own community, but in Zimbabwe, I'm like, okay, everyone is a collaborative for the joint venture of life. The understanding of self is so different. I remember being the first time it was explained to me, I am well if you are well. I think that's part of relationality, that we are only just an entity that's part of a collective community, which is then part of a bigger world.
Now, I was in Zimbabwe, and I was talking about ecosystems, and because I was working in the humanitarian sector, and the INGOs and the Global North impose this kind of hierarchy on people, and they impose all this bureaucracy and regulations, and you can't get funding unless you fill in a million forms, and it drives people crazy. And in Zimbabwe, they were really struggling with funding, and we talked about ecosystems and looking around the local ecosystems, and it's just so interesting that I've been trying to get the INGOs to think about this, and they've been really struggling. I go to Zimbabwe and they're like, yeah, that's it. That's what we do. That's, you know, exactly what we do. We have ecosystems, and we work mutually. We work collaboratively with others, and we partner with others. And it was just really like music to my ears. Like, yeah, and we use them as a case study to kind of share with others about how to do this, because it's such a natural way of being.
For sure. And there is so much a richness, and it's normalized. What you're talking about is normalized. Like down to myself as an Australian woman visiting, if I'm not out by 10 a.m. getting coffee or doing something, people will come. Are you okay? Like that level of collective being is normal. And it is such a, like what you're talking about before, for people in, you know, Western countries, it is something that we have definitely, as we've stepped away from being relational beings, we're definitely, what would you say, experiencing the loss of it.
I mean, one thing I'm exploring at the moment as well is not just collective being, but collective thinking, because in you know, I've been brought up to think, you know, that you go away and you think, and you think hard, and it's like an individual practice. You know, Simon goes away, he sits in his office and he thinks, you know. And yet, when you explore that notion, it's ridiculous, because I'm thinking with many other thoughts. I'm thinking with society around me. I'm thinking with, and I notice I think better in nature. I think better in cafes and people are around me. I think with other people. I think with other objects. I think with other entities, as you would say. You know, so different
For
places.
Sure.
When I get stuck, I go to the beach, and then I think with the beach, and it helps me kind of open up my mind. And So thinking is not just this kind of isolated cognitive kind of practice. Our bodies think, we think with others, don't we?
For sure. And like you say, it's something that is already existing. Like even if someone doesn't have awareness of it, relationality exists. Like you say, if you were to have a thought sitting like on a beach, you know, and if you were to go for the same context and have the same thought sitting like in a snow-capped area, It will be different. But whether or not, it's kind of like, I think of it as a muscle. You know how if you think about a muscle and you train it, it gets stronger. Yeah, we have the capacity. We are relational people, but it's not a muscle that we train or that we, you know, give it recognition. And that I think that the more that we realize exactly what you're saying, interconnectedness with everything, then that particular muscle, you know, it can become more and more and more support, but also a strength. But the big one, Simon, that I absolutely love, and you see this in Zim, and, you know, in community here, I see it, is creativity and innovation.
Mm.
Because the being connected to, like you say, to different landscapes and being open about those connections and celebrating those connections and to other people, to your ancestors, then something changes with creativity and innovation because,
Massively. When I did my PhD and I was, I started to write my book on leadership, I got stuck on the final chapter. I'd done all this research on leadership in the past, and I'd analysed leadership, and I was then thinking, like, what is the future holding for us? You know, what kind of leadership do we need for the future? Mm. And I was stuck, and I was like, and I was waiting, and I was being patient, and I was travelling, and I found myself in the US, and I was I went on a road trip, and I went to the Big Sur, and I drove along, and I saw this sign, and it said Hermitage, and I followed this road up this mountain to this hermitage, and on top of this mountain lived these monks, and they invited me into their community, and I lived with them for a few just a few days, like I think it's 5 days that I was there, and they made me welcome, and I was in probably the most beautiful place I can imagine, overlooking the Pacific Ocean with these giant redwood trees, and it was just awesome. And I was in community as well, and it was like I was in silence, I was in community. And it was there that eco-leadership came to me, that these ecosystems, and it was, I think the place was thinking for me, like, it gave me the next, like, 15 years of my life's work from that place, you know, and it's just so important to think with others and to think with place and to be located in a certain space, I think.
Mm-hmm. But can I also challenge you then, listen to your story, which is absolutely gorgeous, that you were not alone.
No.
I don't know who your ancestors are, Simon, but like at that point when you're driving along the road and you see that sign, Hermitage, I'm going to go there.
Yeah.
You're not alone. And then, you know, perhaps one of the monks had a dream that you were coming. And then, you know, the particular animals and whatever the season was while you're there. The whole thing, it's a beautiful story.
Yeah, the monasteries are a place where they retain a similar way of, you know, it's different, but it's a similar way of being to what you're describing, because I was in the monastery and they say their prayers and they pray for, you know, they pray for kind of the war in Ukraine or something, that they pray for like current events, they pray for someone who's sick in their community, and then all of a sudden they say, and we pray for Thomas so and so who died in 1236.
And that,
they have this like connection to kind of like, as if it's, you know, just present in them. So their ancestors are part of their everyday as well. It's very, very interesting, you know, and time just disappears.
Sure.
It's beautiful.
Yes, for sure. And also, can I ask in that moment, was it also the animals and the particular plants that were part? Yes.
The trees, especially, the trees were just like speaking to me, and there was deer, like as I drove up the drive to the hermitage, deer was there and just beautifully to be with. So yeah, real, real present. I mean, another shock I got, I was in the my son died. I had a son who died very sadly, like just over a decade ago, and you know, I've been grieving a lot about that sudden death. It's a violent death. And I was walking through the forest in Poland, and a deer, a huge deer, just jumped out in front of me, and I was like, that's Finn, he's saying hello to me. And it was like, it was, and I had no animist ideas in my head, like I had no, you know, but I just knew that was Finn surprising me, because he had a great sense of humor, and he'd jump out and he'd do that kind of thing to me. And the liveliness of the deer, the whole kind of presence of that deer, it's like, And now I look for Finn visiting me in nature, you know. So I you know, we look at the certain skies and the light. My children say, look, there's Finn waving to us when the sun comes through the skies, you know. So when you start becoming aware of it and open yourself up, it's there,
for sure.
isn't it?
For sure. And can I ask, do you think that, like, you know, we have the history in the Western world of the, you know, the great chain of being, and then from that, you know, words such as animist, pagan, where things started to get in a way sorted and labeled and that type of stuff. Do you think that there's a possibility of going back to holding relationships with all entities of the world for all sorts of positive reasons, for balance, for the safety of our universe, for relationships between people, for people to have, you know, a broader support system? Do you foresee that it can happen?
I think it has to happen, you know. So I'm wedded to the idea that is our only path actually, like, you know, because all the other world problems won't get solved unless we go to that place, unless we realize our interdependence, our connectivity, our relationships, unless we kind of embody them. I don't think we're going to address, you know, the challenges we face. So I do, and in my own life, you know, I grew up in a very secular life. I you know, we didn't, and I can just see the shifts in my own life, and I think there, you know, there's a massive opening. People are becoming more aware. You know, there's also a massive resistance. Let's not pretend there's not a massive resistance. There's a massive running away from this and nationalism, and people going back to pretend there's no climate change and stuff. But I see a growing awareness, I think there's this. One of my great hopes is based on disenchantment, that I work in all sorts of organizations, and even people are putting on, they're wearing masks and they're trying to be positive and they're, you know, doing their best and everyone's trying to kind of work hard. But there's actually a deep disenchantment. When I coach people, I pick up this, like, the first thing I do is get people to locate themselves. Like, where's your place? I ask people, where's your place? Because that's a starting point now. So that they have to kind of find their place. And it's like, what is this mad coach doing asking me about my place? You know, they're expecting me to solve their managerial problems. And I'm like, no, just breathe. Just feel your body and talk about your place. And when you go to those spaces, it's like people start to transform in front of you. People start to kind of, you know, that they get in touch with their ancestors. They get in touch with their grandparents. They get in touch with the places they've lost. And you start opening up a different space. And when people connect, they become re-enchanted. They start to become re-engaged.
Can I say something about my own disenchantment?
Mm-hmm.
I will see humans, you know, all different humans, you know, from all different cultures, have such experiences. And for some, yes, it does. It is resounding and it holds. But for many that I see, it doesn't hold. Uh-huh. And I've started to think there seems to be a almost like a, you know, the Western idea of, you know, being disassociated from land, disassociated from the spirit world, seems to be a really strong magnet. And then over time, you know, with social influences, with, you know, there seems to be a magnet away. So I started to, I went back reading a fair bit of Steve Biko, I write what I like, and Black Consciousness. And I know that was a movement from the a strong movement from the 70s that is still relevant now. But there seems to be almost needs to be a conscious acts of handing over space for Indigenous consciousness, Aboriginal consciousness, Black consciousness, because there has been in the history what we call like a muffling, a silencing of these ontologies, of these worldviews, and all the perspectives and knowledges that come from it. When I was sitting in Zim, a bunch of Zimbabwe African people just had an informal conversation about this principle called Ukuma. And I was like, what are you talking about? What's that? And he goes, oh, Ukuma. And from their description, it's one principle out of hundreds that they probably have. And it meant kind of like relatedness or relationality over time, past, present, and future. And I was like, what? You've got a principle that means that? So there is so much in this world of relationality, so much to be learnt. And it's almost like, you know, when you have, let's say if you and I were to have a tiff, or an argument.
Yeah.
There would be that initial conversation where we're like, okay, let me just hear from you.
Mm-hmm.
Let me listen. And so I think that that moment of actually creating space for the people groups that for such a long time haven't had a voice to be able to speak about some of this. And the absolute, what would you say, gold nuggets that would come from these conversations and the benefit that they'd have for humanity, without price. So that's probably something I love doing conversations with all different people, and I love to talk about, like, similar to yourself, you know, who are you, what mm-hmm. makes you strong, but then to also create space for these different forms of consciousness that haven't had an opportunity.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I've gone back to consciousness raising as well, because, the 70s and the 80s, black consciousness, you know, women's consciousness, there was a kind of an idea that collectively we had to kind of shift our mindsets and shift our ways of being. And that's not used very often these days. You know, people kind of talk about individual change, but I think there is a collective consciousness raising which has to kind of take place. It's easy to be disenchanted because there's a lot of forces against this. There's a lot of retreat. There's lots of kind of fight back against. There's a fear of engagement, you know. But I think our struggle, I think the struggle of people across the world and for beings across the world is to raise that consciousness. And there's a great joy to it, like you say, to be connected, to be relationally engaged with nature around you, with our ancestors is. Not just kind of an act for good. It's actually a place of joy and a place of belonging.
For sure, and you know, those two words that I love, innovation. Especially when, like you said, like you started off with this conversation that the Western thought has brought so much good, and I totally agree with you. You know, in so many different areas, technology and medicine, and so many areas. But to allow space for sovereign indigenous or African or Aboriginal intelligences, there's an Aboriginal academic here, Lester Irubina Rigney, and he will say over and over again, there have been thinkers as great as Plato in these indigenous communities mm-hmm. for thousands of years. Just give us a chance to talk, and let us talk better. There's a beautiful video snippet of someone, an elder from obviously an indigenous community in South America, talking about the relationship between the little brother and the big brother, and they are actually a gift, some of these ways of thinking, and the big one that I love to see, Simon, is the joy. Mm-hmm. I think when people start to think of themselves within the world from relationality, then that experience of that their family is so much bigger. Yes, they might have family that are people they're related to, but to think of themselves as an entity within a universe that there is so much more family, it's a beautiful thing.
Yeah, I mean, the other beautiful thing I think we can learn from First Nations and remind ourselves is your tradition of yarning, of storytelling, of songs, of where how knowledge is passed on, how we understand each other, how we kind of evolve, is like storytelling is very important to you, isn't it?
For sure, and it's interesting. I've heard the term oral societies for a long mm-hmm. time, and some people, it's different people, but in some worlds, to say something from an oral society is to say that it's less than, it's less intelligent, it's less sophisticated. But it's been really healing for me as an Aboriginal woman to hear new research coming out that in actual fact, oral societies who a particular dance might actually hold pieces of information around where's the closest water source, or what are the seasons for this area, or what animals are around. Or a landform might also hold information that this symbolic, mm-hmm. Whole knowledge in symbolic ways is actually a really high level of sophisticated learning and creative ways of knowing. So that's been a full circle for me, that one.
Yeah, and I think that's another thing that's a learn, because we do kind of put, you know, you've done your studying in universities and stuff, and both you and I have probably left the university because it's not the place where we, you know, it's been a great help for me. Like, doing a PhD was really, really great, and that is really useful, but I didn't want to spend my life there because it's too disembodied. It's just too kind of away from kind of like, you know, I know you're much happier in Zimbabwe than you are in the ivory tower of a university.
For sure. I think the text can be limited, but you know, the combination that, you know, symbolic knowledge, which is, you know, art, dance, song, poetry, you know, it was so beautiful in Zim to realize that an African person will, yes, have a totem, but they'll actually have connected to that particular animal poems, poem that is handed down through generations. So when a person from a particular totem is returning home after a long day doing something, their family will actually sing to them their poem to make them feel strong.
Yeah, that's beautiful. I mean, I think some people, when they listen to these sort of conversations, they think, is it going back into the past or something? And for me, it's really about, and I know you're because you studied in universities and you do critical theory as well and things, you bring together, and for me, it's bringing together we have to kind of relearn some things we've lost. We have to kind of weave together new ways of living in this relational ontology, in this relational way. And it's not about just getting rid of kind of what we've already got. It's about how we can weave it together and see the world differently and work together in new ways, I think.
Yeah, definitely. I've been using the word infuse.
Okay, beautiful.
I'm totally with you, Simon, on that one. And I do see the word traditional used, you know, for Indigenous or First Nations ways of knowing. But I have to quote, like, there's a deadly, deadly means amazing, fantastic, super wonderful, deadly Aboriginal man, Scott Gorringe, that he said in one of his articles, my ancestors held answers for every contemporary problem that we can have now. Mm-hmm. So it's knowing that our cultures are dynamic, so they're changing. But there are key principles that hold, supposing, say, natural law or relevance, you know, going far into the future, and healing as well.
Sure. Michelle, we could yarn for ages. It's beautiful talking with you. I ask guests on my podcast a question just to get you to think a bit. I ask what it means to live a good life and to create a good society. And we've been talking about that for the last hour or last 40 minutes. But any thoughts for the audience just on your experience of what it means to live a good life and create a good society?
I think to create a good life is to be able to let go. To let go of what you know and to let go of what you hold. Mm-hmm. It's a big one, that one, because then in the process of letting go, to look up and to see the actual context that you're in, like, well, are there butterflies in front of my face? Am I standing next to a river? Is there a beautiful human being that I've never met before smiling at me?
Yeah.
Is someone trying to wave hello? I think that would be what I would recommend.
Beautiful. Michelle, keep your good work going, and we must get you over to Ireland to run some workshops. It'd be wonderful. You take care.
Thank you, Simon. Thank you.